He must be seen to be believed. So try to visualize him now. He's 6'4" or 6'5", and we call him the original thin man with a big personality. So let's have a look at Barry Duke.
Well, that was Carol Levis introducing me in 1954. And I had been in show business 3 years at the time, and actually won a radio talent competition in 1951. And I joined the Carol Levis Discoveries, which was a touring company at that time, going around the place, entertaining. And within a few weeks, he realized that I could read and write. And I'd been promoted to manager and compere of a second company. It went round the country in the very small theatres, the Dumps. And I was 23 years old at the time, but it was a great place to learn my business. From Levis, I went into the music halls on my own, doing a stand-up act. And that's an important part of my life, because it was there that I met Marty Feldman, with a man who I wrote many, many shows with, and who was a great friend until he died very sadly when he was quite young, back in 1982. But little did we know when we first met on a music hall bill in York, that 10 years after that meeting in 1955, we would be partners and writers of one of the most successful radio series of all time, Round the Horn. And that came later, but I'll come back to that in a moment. But Marty and I we started off actually arguing about billing. I mean, we were both bottom of the bill comics, and we argued which one was the most bottom of the bill, you know. And we got on ever so well. We realised we had a lot in common with each other. And one day he said to me, "You know, you look funnier in the street than you do on the stage." I went, "Well, how do you mean, Marty?" He said, "Well, look, on the stage you wear a suit, suede shoes, and you tell a few jokes and you sing a song." I said, "So?" He said, "Well, in the street, look at you." He said, "You wear a cheese cutter cap, jacket, old school tie, carry an umbrella. It looks much funnier. Why don't you try it on stage?" So that night, or rather the following night, I went on the stage and I dreamt an opening line, which is, "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I expect you're wondering why I sent for you." And then I said, standing there looking like this archetypal English idiot, "I'd like to make it quite clear before I go any further that I'm not an American." And from that moment, my act got better and better and better, and I went round the musical circuit, finishing up with the big Empire theatres of the day, including the dreaded Glasgow Empire, which was, as tradition had it, an English comedian always died there. I died a death. Didn't get a single laugh from the beginning of the week to the end. The thing I remember most vividly of that week was I followed a performing seal act. It's a play, "God Save the King," on motor horns. You see, and I used to walk onto my act, and the stage was full of wet footprints or flipper prints. It was terribly disconcerting. Anyway, I did my stuff, and I stuck it out, and I won it. Anyway, shortly after that, I went into West End Review. And once you're in West End, the BBC producers come round and they offer you spots on radio shows. But I couldn't afford scriptwriters. I wasn't getting much money, even though I was in the West End. And I thought, well, I can't earn anything as a performer, because in those days I would be paid £8 to perform, and a script would cost 10. And I'm not a mathematician, but it struck me even at that time that I was £2 out of tune every time I put a broadcast. So I started to write for myself. And in fact, the material went better, and people started to use me more often. And other comedians would say to me, "Who wrote your material?" And I said, "Well, I wrote it." And they said, "Well, would you write one for me?" And I said, "Okay." So I became what Frank Muir described in those days as a comedian's labourer. They were the comedians, and you laboured for them, and they went out and ruined your material. And I suppose the most successful did in that period was working with a man called Eric Merriman. We created a radio programme called Beyond Our Ken, which I worked on the first 40-odd programmes with him, and he'd carried on alone. I was headhunted by Granada Television to write, and subsequently with Marty Feldman. And Marty and I had become great friends in this time, and we would meet on a regular basis and write silly things for ourselves to amuse each other. And then we started doing things professionally. We wrote the last series of The Glums. When Frank Muir and Dennis Norden went to television, we were asked, would we write the Glum part of Take It From Here? So we did that. And we also wrote a series called We're in Business, which starred Peter Jones with Dick Emery, Harry Worth, and Irene Handel. They were great performers, as you can imagine. We were young writers, and it was a delight to write for them. But they were strange. I remember Irene Handel was a very odd lady. And she came up to us one week, and she said, "Boys?" "Yes, Miss Handel." "Said, boys, you don't believe in the Bible, do you?" We thought, what irreligious stuff have we put in without knowing? And we said, "How do you mean, Miss Handel?" She said, "Well, in the Bible, it says men and women were created equal. and you've given Harry Worth more lines than you've given me this week. And the following week, Harry Worth came out and said, hey, boy. Oh, my dad, I don't like to worry you, but you're doing other things. But is this a dirty word? Do you want me to say this dirty word? I said, well, what dirty word is that? He went, candle bra. Harry, candelabra. What with writing all day and performing in the theatre at night, doing the occasional radio shows and then doing cabaret, I soon had to work out whether I was going to be a writer or a performer. Obviously, I couldn't do both because I wasn't getting any sleep. So I thought, well, of the two, I'd rather be a writer, because a performer, you're stuck. Where you're the theatre is, that's where you have to be. Whereas if you're a writer, at least theoretically, you can write anywhere. So I decided I would become a scriptwriter and get performing. As I said, with Marty Feldman, the Glums, and We're in Business. And then we wrote a few episodes of The Army Game for Granada Television, and we wrote Bootsy and Snudge. We invented Bootsy and Snudge. And we wrote that, it was 100 programmes. We didn't write them all, but we wrote quite a body of them. Won awards for that, wrote for Frankie Howard at the same time. And in time, we came to the one that people most remember Marty and I for as writers, and that's Round the Horn. And I'd like to play a little extract from it in a moment. This is not one of the traditional bits. This is a piece of a sketch that we wrote called The Maltese Brass Monkey. Based, you'll be not surprised to hear, on the Maltese Falcon. And it's set in Cow, and Kenneth Horne plays the part of Captain Knees Breath McWhirter or some such name. Kenneth Williams plays the sinister Fu Manchu in Ginsburg, and the whole thing sounds rather like this.
Greetings! My name is Lo Min-sing.
Yes, I've seen you mincing along the waterfront.
Now listen to me. If you can bring me the Maltese Brass Monkey, I shall pay you a vast sum of money. But I must have it tonight.
What?
The Maltese Brass Monkey. I have friends in Moscow. They would pay me well for it. But I must get the Brass Monkey there before the cold weather.
Well, I'm your man. Don't worry, Min-sing, I'll find the Maltese Brass Monkey. I hurried back to my hotel, but there in my room, a surprise awaited me. On the bed was something I had never expected to see. A clean bedspread. And on it, the seductive curves and the smooth, flawless yellow skin of a banana. The girl eating it looked up. She spoke.
My name is Tiger Lily.
Any relation to Beatrice Lily?
That sort of is a sort of technique we use, a mixture of silliness and quite well-thought-out routines, of, you know, Tiger Lily, Beatrice Lily, the banana leading to the girl eating it, and so forth. Lady in the front row.
I just wondered how difficult it was to write for Kenneth Williams. He was a very egotistical man, and I wonder whether he stuck to the scripts or did he go off with ad-libs?
No, I think that in the whole 66 programmes, I think we said six ad-libs, that I can remember. We listen. I mean, the great thing about good writers, I say that as if I was one, is that you listen to people. If you're working for an actor, if it's Frankie Howard, you listen to Frankie Howard. You try to hear Frankie Howard in your head. If you're writing for Kenneth Horne, you try to hear Kenneth Horne in your head. If you're writing for Jim Davidson, God preserve us, you would write, if you hear Jim Davidson in your head, whatever it might be, and Kenneth Williams, doing all those things, voices, we would harness that. Because it's simpler to harness what the performer can do than to try and create something he can't do, obviously. So he would do something, and we'd catch on to it, and we'd say, old man, Jim Peace, old grandfather. He goes, oh, I'd like to join and work at the BBC. Why do you want to work at the BBC? I'd like to get my hands on Judith Chalmers. No, what do you want to do? I'd like to get her in a broom cupboard. And then now, education. Private. Oh, you've had a private education. No, I mean, mind your own business. It's not difficult to write like that. Once you've got the voice in your head, because that's how the man will react. As I say with Julian and Cindy, that's how they spoke. That's their attitude. Cool, don't you look old? Do you think they're his own teeth? Mm. In 1969, Marty Feldman and I had completed two very successful television series for Marty called Marty. Marty went off to perform for ATV, commercial television. And I didn't really want to write jokes anymore. I was looking for a desk job. And the BBC, fortuitously, asked me to become the advisor to their comedy department, which I did. And I worked for a madman called Michael Mills. An amiable madman, I have to say. Very good boss to me. But we used to argue like mad. And he would say, Took asks you a question, and halfway through you realise he's giving you an order. He's like Baron von Richthofen and his damn flying circus. So when I put together the idea of using John Cleese and Graham Chapman and Michael Palin and Terry Jones and the rest to them, he said, oh, God, it's Took's flying circus again. Baron von Took flies again, all those jokes, you see. So I persisted and made them see that although these chaps all knew each other and all worked around and about in television, they'd never worked together before in that formula. So when they eventually, the BBC agreed that it would be all right, and they asked the team, the Python team, for a title, and they came up with Wither Canada. Doesn't ring a bell much, does it, when you think about it? Then they came up with Owl Stretching Time, and Madman Mills said, I'm sick of this, it's going to be called The Circus. Anything circus, because it's all on the memos now. People will be confused if we call it something else now. So John Cleese, I think it was, maybe it was Michael Palin, who can say now, came up with Monty Python. It became Monty Python's Flying Circus. There you go.
My 17-year-old son asked me, if I'd been alive then, would I have liked Monty Python? Did you write for a certain audience, which was my age then? We felt obliged, even though I loved it, anybody that didn't like it, we thought were peculiar or didn't have a sense of humour or weren't part of the age at the time. Were you writing for a certain age of audience?
No, all right, let's make it clear. I wasn't writing. I never wrote Monty Python's Flying Circus. I invented it. I created the setup in which it existed. I sold it to the BBC because I was working for the BBC. And I thought the BBC should have this programme. I didn't know whether it would be a success or a failure at the time. But I trusted those men and I made sure the BBC trusted them. They wrote their own sense of humour for their own people, their own kind, their own time. Everybody does that. All good writers write that way. I mean, when you're writing for something, you're not creating anything but your own world in another shape, in a curious way. And, of course, it stretches out because people are similar, generation after generation. Not much happens to people. People are very much the same. They laugh at the same sort of things. They are frightened of the same sort of things. And if you can encourage that feeling of togetherness between the performer and the audience, you've created something that's really worth the trouble. And that's what the Pythons did extremely well, because the charm of Palin and Jones and those, and the sheer force of Cleese and that's just magic for me. Magic. I watch them again and again with undiluted pleasure. I can remember once the boss of the whole department came to me in the office of Barry, and I said, yes. He said, I've just watched a playback of Monty Python. Does John Cleese have to say bastard twice? I said, if it's John Cleese and if that's what he wants to say, yes. And that was about the only censorship we ever had on it. The same time I put Barry Humphries on television for the first time. I'd like to apologise for that. Anyway... Then when those two were safely on, I was invited to go to Hollywood to work on Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. And the BBC gave me 4 months' leave. And I went up, dressed more or less as I am most days, in a suit, shirt, tie, and so on. And I was in Hollywood in this clobber. It didn't seem to fit everywhere. So after we'd been there a week or two, I went to a store on Sunset Boulevard. It was a Western store, and I bought all this Western gear. Check shirt, a big bandana around my neck. With a clasp and a belt with a huge buckle, tight strides and boots. And I turned up for the writers' meeting the next day, and the head writer said, we bought over an English gent, now we've got a fag cowboy. And then came those are two things that people know me most for. One was the television programme Points of View, and the other was the news quiz, and they happened more simultaneously. But I'll talk about Points of View, if I may, in the beginning. I did it, I had a contract for 13 programmes, because Bill Cotton, who was the head of entertainment then, had bought American sitcoms, which were only 25 minutes, because they're commercial. They needed a five-minute filler, and I was the five-minute filler. And I wrote these programmes, and they became quite successful, so they spread it out. And eventually I did up 294, I think, programmes altogether, over a period of 7.5 years. Thousands and thousands of letters. People still ask me, when are you going back on that programme? I said, never. I've done that in the past. This is I put some of the letters that I got, typical of the sort of stuff that people wrote to me. Here's one from the Vicarage, Pentire Road, Newquay, Cornwall. Dear Mr. Took, I feel that your programme typifies the attitude of the BBC. It is self-indulgent, self-satisfied, purposeless and smug. It represents nothing but the views of a sampling of those too apathetic to find a useful and creative form of amusement and seems to congratulate them for their pointless behaviour. I suppose no other organisation would employ anyone as completely complacent as yourself. I really mean this. Yours truly, a well-wisher. P.S. I am not the vicar. I got this out of the file. from Braunton, Devon, Mr. W.T. White wrote to me in 1983. Dear sir, the BBC is showing far too many doggy programmes, e.g. One Man and His Dog and Training Dogs the Woodhouse Way. My dog watches these programmes and now walks like Mrs. Woodhouse. The main subject was filth and blasphemy and all those things. And you really know you're on a bad thing when you get a letter from Anonymous of Aldershot. And particularly if he gets your name wrong. And you can't possibly know when you're reading all these letters what the writer sounds like. So I assume this Anonymous of Aldershot sounds like one of the Kenneth Williams characters that we read in Round the Horn, that J.P.'s old grunt fighting. Dear Mr. Rook. Dear Mr. Rook, I switch on my set in the hope of a bit of sex and violence, but alas, none, which must distress millions of people. My suggestion is that BBC One should show good, clean films, comedy, etc. BBC Two to give us what we want, i.e. sex and violence. It would boost BBC Two's viewing figures tenfold. I bet it would. There's a sad postscript. P.S. Could you tell me where in Aldershot I can get a slack woman before my memory fades? People say, did you ever have a letter that you cherish more than any others? And it's, I have one here. It's from an eight-year-old, Mark Pellner. It was eight and a half, actually, when he wrote it. He comes from Melksham, and he wrote this piece of blinding logic on the subject of Star Trek. On Star Trek, they say at the beginning, to boldly go where no man has gone before. But when they reach places, people are always already there. Wonderful, isn't it? Well, I think it is. Anyway, I did that for a time, and simultaneously I said I was doing a news quiz, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I took over from Barry Norman when he went to America to interview film stars, and I thought I'd have it for a couple, maybe a week or two. I didn't know, but I did 17 years at it. But some of the cuttings that have been brought through the years have been truly terrific, and particularly I remember them because of the people who brought them. For instance, Tony Hawk's a very fine young comedian, I think. He brought this notice that appeared in the canteen of a police station in Christchurch, New Zealand. Will the person who took a slice of cake from the commissioner's office return it immediately? It is needed as evidence in a poisoning case. Francis Wheen of The Guardian brought us this from the Churchdown Parish magazine. Would the congregation please note that the bowl at the back of the church, labelled for the sick, is for monetary donations only. Jeremy Hardy brought us this from an English newspaper published in the Algarve. Police are treating as suspicious the death of a vegetarian jogger killed by an 8-pound leg of lamb thrown from a third-floor window. There's a small ad from the Shropshire Star. For sale, Rottweiler bitch, lovely temperament, reluctant to let go. The Daily Telegraph's TV sports pundit, Joe Theismann, commented on the retirement of San Francisco quarterback Joe Montana, said, "We should be careful about using the word genius to describe a football player. A genius is a guy like Norman Einstein." I think he meant Albert Feinstein. He's probably got it wrong, however. This is another oldie, but it's done the sort of cute, the sort of thing we used to get bright people writing in. In the letters column of the Midlands newspaper, this item appeared. That my husband and I recently toured the US, staying at several motels. Discount was available to people over 55 if they were members of certain American organizations. When asked if he had any memberships that would qualify us for such a saving, my husband produced his B&Q 10% over 60s card. We were delighted to have this accepted time and time again. Only on one occasion where we asked what the B&Q stood for. We answered Bush and Quail. But the many people who appeared on the news quiz, my two absolute favourites were Peter Cook and John Wells. Now, Peter Cook had an amazing sense of humour, and both of them knew that I would giggle at the drop of a hat. And they both used to work on me to try and make me collapse with laughter, which I frequently did, but disgraceful behaviour, but I used to enjoy them so much. And here is an example of Peter in action. You hear also in this Nick Clark, Alan Corran and Richard Ingrams. Richard, your turn for question. What crisis was crowned by a right Charlie?
It's this week's Royal Book. There's a new one every week now. And the latest one is Charles's apology for himself, which is to say that Really, it's everyone else's fault.
I think he's been tremendously brave.
He has.
To reveal that he has met Jonathan Dimbleby in person and talked to him for a while.
Really? I want to read the memoirs of all these blokes who knocked him about at Gordonstone. And they were all lining up. Dang, one on them.
They said things like, with ears like that, you'll never be king, don't they? Unkind.
Bloody good
like
school,
that.
Isn't it? It's clever school.
Well, clever swine, aren't they? That didn't repeat. We didn't go wide.
I was told I'd never be king. very early on. I didn't go wagging the breast, no.
Of course
I didn't.
You took it like a man.
I took it like a hermaphrodite, which I was told I was.
There you are. Typical piece of ad-libbing from the newsgirls. John Wells was an exceptional man. He was a kind of a genius in all sorts of ways. I described him in another radio programme recently, I seem to remember, as being both iconoclastic and an icon. He was a teacher at Eton at one time. He was a satirist. He worked on Private Eye. He did a lot of stuff with Richard Ingram. He was super, a very funny man, much, much missed. And I'd like to more or less conclude my account of myself by remembering this wonderful man.
John,
what's got 16 limp wrists and cruises the ocean floor?
Is this a homosexual octopus?
Yes. Or, to put it more plainly, two homosexual octopuses.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
Well done, John.
There we are. You see, I knew about that. I read about it in Gay News. Are they still published? Is it off the coast at Bourne that these gay octopuses are? You wonder what all the security is for after the IRA have gone. To keep gay octopuses from upsetting the...
If you haven't heard of Lady Thatcher.
Oh, indeed. Or Miss Portillo. That would be very sad. If a huge, enormous gay octopus suddenly arose from the well and tangling one of its tentacles around his leg and dragged him giggling into the water. that isn't the answer. No.
Yes, it is. That'll do me. And people ask me what I'm going to do now. Well, I look back at my career, and I don't think I've had a career. I've had a series of happy accidents. There's been a lot of serendipity, and I've had a wonderful time, but they are happy accidents. And people say, what are you planning to do now? I say, well, I'm just waiting for the next happy accident. Another question?
You wrote a book on Max Miller.
Yes.
Do you think if he'd been working today, would he have been as successful as he was in his time?
Yes, I think he would. He had an unusual personality. He was very outspoken, and he ignored taboos, the sexual taboos of his day, the 30s and 40s. It was all rather furtive back in the 30s. But Max Miller broke through with all sorts of jokes about the joys of sexual encounters. It wasn't dirty. He was just talking about things that other people kept mum about. And his audiences love him because they wanted to talk about that. They didn't know how. And he demonstrated how. And he'd come out to an audience and he'd put the onus straight onto the audience. He'd say, I've got a white book, I've got a blue book. In the white book, it's all the clean jokes. And in the blue book, it's all the other ones. Now, which book do you want? And the audience would shout, the blue book, Max, the blue book. And the blue book they got. So they got what they asked for.
Have you written a book about your own life?
Yes, I have. It was remainded after 2 weeks. Lack of interest. No, I think there are only two sorts of autobiographies. One like mine, which is the truth and is dull, and one that's a pack of lies and sells in millions, as in Jeffrey Archer. And, I don't really mean that. And if you're listening, Jeffrey... Gentlemen here. Yes.
Just with round the horn, how did you get away with it?
What? What are we supposed to get away with?
Why is it funnier, longer than Monty Python has been? Is it because it goes back to the old musical tradition?
Well, obviously the musical tradition comes into it. Marty and I both came out of the musical, so we knew all that stuff. And we were, you know, we were moderately well-educated, though we'd left school at 15, both of us, and run away, as it were. We were both reasonably well-read. And so there are a lot of literary quotes in it, as much literature in Round the Horn as Double Entendre. But when you're invited to write something, you write for the performer and what they can do. In the case of Julian and Sandy, where most of the flack lies, originally we wrote them as two old men. That was the original sketch. We wrote two old actors who were filling in between acting engagements, doing housework, which was traditional back in the 60s. And one was called J. Behemoth Cadogan, and the other was called something else. T. Hamilton Grosvenor. That's what it was. And the producer was having a touch of black dog that day, and he phoned us and said, "It's not funny this week. The show's not funny." He said, "What's wrong?" "Well, these old men, they're sad. They're not funny at all. Can't you make them chorus boys?" "Well, all right, we'll make them chorus boys, as you like it. You know, we'll make them chorus boys." So once you're saying chorus boys, you write chorus boys. And chorus boys spoke like that, acted like that, behaved like that. I knew a lot of them because of my time in the Western Theatre. And how that Bone to Vardy or Dolly Old Eagle game was a commonplace to me. So that's what we wrote. And a lot of people knew what it was about and shrieked with laughter. A lot of people just thought it was funny. Didn't see there was a double entendre in it. And that was fine. All the slang was there. And if you knew it, it was funny and it was dirty as well. But if you didn't know, it wasn't dirty at all. To the pure, all things are pure. The double entendre bit, we sailed pretty close to the wind. But it was the swinging 60s. It was a permissive time. We weren't dodging out of our time and creating anything. We were part of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Till Death Us Do Part. And that was the week that was. We were part of that era. We didn't know it, but that's what we were, it turns out. And it worked. It lasts. You can't plan that. We wrote it for that week. We didn't write it for eternity. We wrote it for 7 days, and that was it. And wrote something else. If you believe that, you'll believe anything. No.